It's the Help Show. Finally, we are here to discuss everything to do with the questions that you've sent us to ask us for help. And we've had quite a few. Some doozies, actually, has to be said. First question, though, came from Dougie. He said, where's the frigging Help Show? Isn't it ironic that I need help to find the Help Show, don't you think? Thanks, Dougie. We will put them in iTunes. After this one's recorded, we'll edit heavily, and then we'll post them up. So there'll be a Help Show in iTunes every 2 weeks from now on, I promise. Joining me to sort your problems out and answer your questions, fantastic bunch, top left, Mr. Wheatley, who is here to answer your questions on web and Mac and iOS. Then we've got Paul Shadwell, who's from Switzerland, and he's going to answer your questions on Windows and Mac, probably dominantly perhaps, and a little bit of iOS as well. Sarah, our Linux girl, is here as well with a bit of web to help and a bit of sysadmin stuff. And the jack of all trades from Fresh Tech, it's Rick McCorriston, making his BTN debut. Long overdue, dude.
I think I'm out of my depth, actually.
Oh, have you looked at the questions? You didn't look at the questions first.
I am now. They're all very complicated.
No, they're not. That's rubbish. Right, so here we go. First question that we've got in from you. Thank you very much for those people that have bothered to send in. John Marks in Peterborough. I'm a frequent visitor to Mac Update and often download the freeware /shareware on offer. I feel that the site's pretty trustworthy for software, but wondered what's the real risks are to me as a Mac user. Presumably far greater risks exist for Windows users. Are there even any sites that are similar for Windows users, or would that be just too stupid and dangerous? And Sarah as well, I've put a note on the question here. Sarah, have a think about anything that's available for Linux variants as well here. Let's start off with Mac Update. If people want shareware /freeware, is Mac Update a fairly trusted source? I've always perceived it as that, I have to say.
So I only really use Mac Update if I'm getting sent there by a trusted source. So I can't think of an experience off the top of my head of some software that I've taken from there, but generally I end up on Mac Update because I've clicked on a link on a reputable website that has taken me there, and they're sort of using it as a CDM more than anything else. So I generally am kind of okay with it. Content delivery network. So like basically somebody who has lots of big bandwidth pipes. So your general website maybe doesn't have the funding to set up an entire server farm to pump out all this software, all these big files and things like that. So generally in these kind of things, somebody would employ somebody to be that content delivery mechanism, and they have the big pipes to allow them to pump out the software and the bits quicker.
So you wouldn't say that going to macupdate.com is an instant safe experience. You are flying the risk of getting something horny on your system.
I think it's not as bad as CNET, for example, but I think it's I wouldn't necessarily go there personally and just have a dig about and download some stuff. I would generally only use it if I was sent there by somewhere that I trust, but that's just me.
Pete in the chat room says, fairly sure that Mac Update is fairly good, and it does have a Windows section, but CNET turned version tracker to poo, which I'm not sure what that means, but there we go.
Version tracker was awesome. Version tracker was the place to go to get your software originally,
right,
back in the day, and now it's sort of been taken over by Mac Update. But I mean, apart from anything, you can't download and install from Mac Update unless you tick that little box in your Mac anymore, can you? They've stopped you from downloading and installing anything other than from the App Store, unless you go into the security preferences and tick the Allow from Anywhere button.
Well, you can take stuff that's not in the Mac App Store as long as it's been signed. So there's three different levels. So you've got just from the Mac App Store stuff that people have like jumped into bed with Apple and given them big hugs and stuff, and everybody's happy. And then the third level is your Mac Update stuff. So by default, you can download from the first two. And you have to actually go ahead and switch on for the third.
Yeah, it's a bit like on Android, where Google have got a thing that you have to enable to allow you to download apps from unknown sources. But you specifically have to go in and tick it rather than being allowed to get access to it by default.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that Mac Update is the same sort of idea as like SourceForge.
Okay. I mean, SourceForge.net
for those that are interested.
I go back to what Paul said there. I've kind of only gone to SourceForge when I've been pushed there by another another outlet. So, you know, I think you get, don't you get Quartz X11? Apple reference you to the SourceForge download for that. So,
SourceForge is the only thing
in essence, it's still Linux based.
So is there a, I mean, one of the things I think that, that always used to make the Mac community great was there was tons of free software out there, little apps or little processes that would just help you do some widgets that you could download for the dashboard. And that's what made it great. But is this, I mean, presumably the same sort of system exists for the Linux community, Sarah?
Yes. I mean, the way it tends to work with that is that like Windows, you have your designated repository where there's a place where you can configure which repositories you allow access to. But there are also some other ones that allow some slightly not quite so official things. And the idea is that you actually go in and you configure the repositories, and then it gives you access to stuff when you actually go to install or look for software through software updates through the GUI or using apt-get on from the command line. But I think it's the same basic principle. I'm not particularly familiar with Mac Update, obviously, because I don't really use Mac. So that's why I was asking the question about, is it like SourceForge? That tends to be more the, if you want to find a specific piece of, if you've got the name of a piece of software and you just want to find it, if you Google it, if it's slightly off the mainstream, then, or in some cases, some very well-known software, they actually keep the repositories on there and you can actually download it directly. And that's, I know that SourceForge is also available, also has software on there that isn't just Linux-based. It's also Windows and, I assume, that Mac software on there as well.
So
yeah, there's Mac software on there.
There is.
Yeah, thought there would be. It's a general repository.
So if we've got a threat scale of 1 to 10, 1 being low, 10 being high, or 10 being what the hell are you doing here, I mean, let's take those three basics of kind of Mac outlets for software like Mac Update, CNET, and SourceForge. And what's the threat level for free software for Mac versus Windows versus Linux?
I don't think you can put broad strokes on it like that. My general assumption is that you should assume that everything is compromised unless you can prove it to be otherwise. Or as Paul says, if you go there from a link that's been recommended to you by someone from a trusted source. But even then, you know, I still think, well, you're basically downloading something which will then come inside your file and could do all sorts of nasties. So don't trust it unless it's either been recommended to you or come from a trusted link.
So
it does depend on the level of access it's asking for, though, as well. Because, I mean, if you want to make sure you're downloading from the correct place, you can run a checksum on the downloaded file and all that sort of stuff. But
MD5 hashes and stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I probably wouldn't do that. In a Mac, they don't do it so much anymore, but you can have applications that only run on your user file and don't require root access. So there's just an applications folder in your user folder, in your home directory, and that would only have access within your home directory, so you wouldn't be able to it wouldn't be able to affect anything else on your system. But if it asks for your admin password or the password of an admin, then that means that it's essentially got free reign over all of your system, probably except the keychain. It wouldn't really be able to get into your keychain.
Right. So
a lot of people say, just for normal use, run your Mac with a normal user and not an admin user, and then only use the admin account to install stuff. That's quite a good way of protecting yourself if you are worried about what you're downloading and what it's going to be able to get to on your system. But in general, most things on the net, on Mac Update, seem to be okay. I haven't had any problems.
Yeah. Yeah,
we deal with quite a few Macs.
I agree.
Out of interest, just since we are talking about Mac Update, what sort of process do people have to go through to publish information on there? Is it just Apple and Apple resellers, or you know, whoever that are accredited to Apple that are actually allowed to publish on that?
Nice. I think it's similar to SourceForge. But I think there's probably some money that goes back and forward, and in a way that sort of self-regulates or regulates against the hackers, because there are very few hackers out there that are, or the ones that hit tend to hit most people, like the script kiddies and stuff, that will actually pay to get a threat into the public. There aren't a huge amount of those. So as soon as you have to pay to publish something and get it popular, which you do to a certain extent with Mac Update, and it sort of regulates it, and then you can say, well, this person's paid this money to get this promoted, so chances are it's going to be safe, you know.
Comments from Pete in the chat room, he's saying that Mac Update's better than SourceForge, in my opinion, because of the advert nature, and also saying that he's never had any problems with Mac Update. And I've got to say, I've used Mac Update quite a lot and never had any issues with it, so...
They usually have quite, you know, big offers on there as well. So it's, I get an email from them every so often, and there's been something an app that I know of, I know about, and then I've clicked on it to go and get it, and so far I've not had a problem.
Okay, that's good. But as always, as Sarah says, be careful. Next question from Gordon. So what's the difference between open source, freemium, shareware and free in terms of the software? I've heard all the phrases over the years and I'm told that some you shouldn't touch and some you can touch. It's very confusing, especially now that most apps on my phone are free. Which category would they fall into? I like free, but am I putting myself at risk? And silence.
So... I guess the first thing to tackle there is the difference between open source, freemium, shareware, and free.
Freemium, I would have thought is there's an add-on to it, but I mean,
yeah. So that's an app purchase generally is freemium. Open source and shareware is a bit of an old term. Shareware was around sort of in the late 90s. I haven't really heard that term much recently. It may have morphed into something else. So it's slightly different. Shareware had a little bit of a negative connotation, sort of the late 90s, early 2000s, when that was generally where, like, you found your... I certainly, in that period, I was always looking for shareware because I had wanted free software. I was still in high school. I was in high school in the early 2000s, but late 90s. And I was using shareware, and then all my machines were getting riddled with all sorts of nonsense. So I don't know what the panel think, but I don't think shareware is so much of an issue anymore. It's something you still need to be aware of based on what we were saying before, but I never hear about shareware anymore.
It's about a 90, it's a very much a 90s kind of phrase, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was going to say, I mean, these days, the thing that I think most people refer to when you're looking at how you're going to publish something is using Creative Commons. And there's actually a good page if Gordon's interested in actually finding out, if you go to creativecommons.org/choose, there's a good little mini app there that allows you to select questions, and then it will tell you, you know, create the license for you in terms of the icon. But it, in doing so, it actually allows you to see all the different types of licenses that you can create, and therefore the definitions of what you allow to happen and to be done with the work that you publish. And this goes beyond just software. It's also about content, applications, anything that you can publish in this way. And most of it is around what you, as the author of the work, what you are allowing to be done with that work, and also whether or not it can be used for commercial purposes.
Mm. And then open source is more that the actual developer is kind of going away from your standard business model, whereby I make product A and you give me pile of cash and you can take product A and you can use it for a period of time.
Well, you've got the source code at that point, haven't you? That's the point. Mm. You can do what you want with it. So you were talking on the Pocket Show this week about the fact that the Windows are bringing out, or Nokia are bringing out, a phone running Android but looking very much like Windows. And the key point there was that you said was, this isn't Google, this is Android. This is the source code directly manipulated and converted by Microsoft to look like Windows Phone 8.
Yeah, so that's in the new Nokia X line that they're supposed to be coming out. And they have just taken Android and made it look, for all intents and purposes, I mean, I'm sure you probably could find lots and lots of things that it isn't Android and it isn't Windows. So that's open source. So it's basically the source code is punted out there. I'm going to make a wide sweeping statement. And if you're not taking a Linux environment out of the equation, most sort of open source things that people on a day-to-day basis will happen across is web-based stuff. So the likes of content management systems, WordPress, those kind of things, Joomla, MySource Matrix, that kind of thing. Open source doesn't feature, or certainly in my experience, hasn't featured that heavily on the Mac environment or really on the Windows environment that much. It's very much sort of sectioned off to either web or Linux. And I guess it's kind of connected because most web servers are Linux.
The only one I can think of is Blender, actually. Have you used Blender? It's the 3D modeling, open source 3D modeling.
That's tool. True. Sorry, I thought you meant Bender from Futurama.
he's very open source. Take him and draw him as many times as you'd like.
Gordon, no,
Blender is open source, but I think that's. Is that Java? Is that using Java? I don't know. That's the only one I can think of. Like you say, most of them are web technologies. Mm. And so run on the Mac and on Linux. But open source really isn't about cost, because you can have an open source project that costs you money. Like one of the main ones is Red Hat Enterprise Linux. But the way they do that, you can download and use Red Hat as much as you like. But as soon as you need any help with it, then you need to start paying them some money. So open source is more about being able to see how the actual application works and is made, and if you want, being able to change it.
Gordon in the chat room is saying, thanks for that, great answers. I'm sorry I don't remember writing that question, though. That was Gordon White, not Gordon Jackson.
Some other companies kind of deal with them being open source by they give the software away for free, but then they charge you for the support, or they charge you for kind of after sales and all that kind of stuff as well. So they just work in slightly different business models.
The Razor model.
Sorry?
The Razor model.
Yeah, indeed, the Razor model. Another reference to the Pocket Show. So to answer the question at the end of what he was saying there is, it's very confusing, especially now most apps on my phone are free. Most apps on your phone are free. I don't think they necessarily fall into any of those categories. Some of them do fall in the freemium, so that's your games that you have like add-ons, and so you get the game for free, and then you have to buy more bullets or more coins, like your Farmvilles and all that kind of stuff for cash. I don't think, on most environments, if you're using the official App Store, so like on Android, if you're using Google Play, or on iOS, you're using the App Store, generally you're safe to deal with kind of free stuff. I wouldn't worry too much about that.
Excellent. Good answers. Thanks very much. Next question comes in from Mark Featherston. Dear Ewan, noticed your tweets last week about working in dust and wet conditions when shooting images. Are there any tips which relate to these conditions that you can give? And also, notice the amount of dust and water. What did you use to clean your lenses? Can't believe that lens cloths are very absorbent for the wet. Well, the first thing to say is your lens is attached to your body of your camera. And the first thing to say is don't open that connection as much as you possibly can. If you're in a dusty environment particularly, you want to break the lens to body contact as little as possible. Take a lens cap around with you. Make sure you've got your lens cap, and if you're not using it, stick it back on. You've got to bear in mind as well that the cloth that you wipe your lens with is not what puts the scratches on it. It's the crap that's on the cloth, or the crap that's on the lens, that does it as well. And if you're wiping your lens, you're a complete muppet, because actually what you should be wiping, and I'm unscrewing it here for the audio listeners, is a UV filter. Any lens that you buy, this is a £1,200 lens. There's no way on God's green earth I'm wiping that with a cloth. I'm going to wipe the UV filter. The UV filter cost me 57 quid. So it's very replaceable. If you want, what I use is from Costco. I got piles and piles of these yellow dusters that are like microfibery type things. They're about 15 quid for 60 of them. And they're just terry toweling type stuff. And they're perfect. They're lovely and clean. You can wash them in the washing machine. And then when you've done that, fold them up and stick them in a sandwich bag and zip it shut on the top, and that way you're not putting any contaminants in. And likewise, if you're using one of these that's getting dust off before you do anything else, always wipe the dust clear before you start taking the lens apart, and make sure that you take the dusty one that you've used and put it in a bag so it doesn't introduce contamination onto your other lenses and stuff like that. So just kind of like a barrier technique. But people that that say, you know, you've got to buy a certain type of lens cloth, otherwise, you know, if you don't use the Nikon recommended lens cloth, your warranty's void and all that kind of stuff, it's absolute rubbish. Yeah, it's not the cloth that scratches your lens, it's the crap that's on it. So keep the crap off it. There's the answer.
How do you clean the cloths, Ewan, just to make sure that they're kept okay?
Just washing machine. stick them in. Okay. I'll come back after a week's work, weekend's work or something like that. I'll come home and I'll dump out all my clothes from the weekend, my oranges or something like that, and I'll dump out all the cloths that I've used, and they go in the dishwasher with everything else, or the, not dishwasher, the washing machine with everything else, and they come out the other side. Sharon irons them.
Wow.
I'm very lucky. And then they go back into the bag. And it depends, like I say, if I always keep a couple that are in sandwich bags, because then I know that they're clean and I know that they're sealed away, especially if I'm wiping dirt off it. I was in a tunnel this weekend and that got very dirty and nasty and horrible. So the one that I used to clean my hands and clean the time-lapse cameras off with, I put that back in the Ziploc bag dirty to make sure that I didn't spread the contamination anywhere else. And they're absorbent as well. And the other thing that's nice about these is if you're out and you're really hot, I got this off an old bloke on a railway line, and he said the best thing you can do to cool down is get yourself a neck hanky and roll it up, soak it completely and just wring it out lightly, then get it up into, roll it like a neckerchief, like you'd have at the Scouts, and just tuck it in your shirt, and then that coolness will stay on your skin. And then when you get really, really hot, take it off and wipe your face and just put in a little bit of moisture. If there's a tiny, tiny bit of wind, it'll really cool you down. And I did a job at Wigan Springs last year, and I used that technique, and it was a lifesaver, because it was the hottest I've ever been in my life. It was like Death Valley in Wigan. And that worked really, really well. Really good technique.
Yeah, I've heard that technique in terms of sticking something cold like that on the back of your neck to stop a nosebleed.
Oh, right, okay. I haven't heard that one before. That's cool. Feel free to add anything else to the photographic questions. They're not my domain.
Also, it doesn't expressly say photographs, so they could just be asking about cleaning your glasses.
Yeah, no.
True.
Well, I was tweeting out about lenses, glasses, all right.
I know.
How do you clean your glasses, Paul?
You don't want to ask that question.
Have you got some anal kind of long regime that goes on at night?
So Amazon Subscribe and Save send me
right. I don't glasses, want to ask that question.
Glasses screen wipes. I get a massive pack of them every 2 months, and every night I clean my glasses.
Send me the link, because actually I've my glasses always look like I've wiped them with my arse.
That has been very anal.
I could say there isn't a single person here who doesn't wear glasses. So. There you go. Scratch and save is perfect.
Subscribe.
It's called Scratch and Sniff now.
Diminishing.
Rosemary has sent us two questions. First one, hi, Help Show. I recently bought a new MacBook Air to replace my old black MacBook. That's a quality machine right there. I love it, but when I open contacts, I've got a lot of the contacts as duplicates. Not all of them are duplicated, but quite a lot. Some have different details on them as well. I've deleted the duplicates, but they come back the following day. Please let me know I'm not going mad. Rosemary. When I was sitting, copying and pasting that one into the doc, I thought something's coming back from the past to haunt Rosemary, isn't it?
So that's
and it's just
I would
where.
Imagine that's iCloud. That's iCloud playing some funny buggers there.
I would no. My question would be: if she's let's assume that she's signed in with a .Mac account, that should be live updating from her old black MacBook. And as soon as she goes to the new one, because I mean I run two machines on the same .Mac account, and that it syncs the contact. So I don't know where she's getting different data from or different contact data from.
So I suppose this is all the information we've got. But something that I've experienced is. The duplicates are coming because so there's two different scenarios that I've experienced. One is that they've still got the other MacBook on, and there's just something happening in the matrix that one is updating and then the other one is, and they're getting confused at the same time. And so both of them are writing back both copies. So if she goes on her old MacBook, she'll find two of them there. The other thing is, if it's only one particular contact, I have my address book. There's about 17 Paul Wheatleys in my address book, because every time I add a new Mac, it automatically creates a new Paul Wheatley, because I don't like to migrate information. I like to start from scratch every time. So every time it adds a new Paul Wheatley as the user to that Mac, and I have all sorts of problems around that as well. So
I've had that with a guy named Ian McLeod, who duplicated randomly for no apparent reason across all my platforms. Mm-hmm. But anyone else got any suggestions for Rosemary?
Well, it might be that if she's got multiple accounts, she might have the contacts might be local, and then it can show her the ones that are on iCloud.
So
it might also be showing her Exchange contacts or something like that. If I was her, I'd probably export them all the ones that she's spent all that time getting correct and right, and get sort of a god version of her contacts, and then nuke them from everywhere else, absolutely everywhere else, and then load them back on, because sync issues like that, are just, especially for some reason, when you start changing lots of things with these sync services, you find that they just get, it's almost like the computer gets nervous and doesn't want to delete that much stuff. We have it all the time, especially with Exchange and address book. But the solution is just to get a really good local version, not in the cloud or anything. Get rid of everything else and upload your gold master of contacts.
Yeah,
any way around it, really.
My thought was, because in address book, doesn't it tell you you can set the dominant copy to be the MacBook or the cloud?
Yeah, I think you can in iCloud, actually. Yeah, and that's really handy. I mean, normally the default we use is always that whatever's on the web is the default. You know, with email and calendars and contacts, the absolute gold master is what's on the web and what's on the, because that's on the server. You know, whatever's on your computer, however many computers you have, is essentially a replication of what's on the server. So,
yeah. My only thought was that she's got, say, the black MacBook had local as the master copy, and the MacBook Air is defaulting to iCloud because it'd be newer, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, possibly.
But that wouldn't account for, because they'd all change then. They'd all duplicate. I can't think why a few would and why there'd be old copies. But I mean, the one thing that I found as well, though, when I had when I went from iPhone to Windows Phone, I had the issue of how do I sync my contacts, and I just stopped all of the Mac contacts and used Gmail to sync across both platforms, and I've had no issues since.
It's been absolutely perfect. I know this is a Mac question, but my thought was to use Google Contacts for everything. Mm. I do that now. It just makes life so much easier.
I'd agree with that as well. They just haven't figured out calendars, email, and contacts at all yet. I mean, it's only been around for 30 years or whatever. But I'd go with Google's. It's just Google's manage it a lot better.
Google no cloud stuff, and all much as I love Apple, they just haven't worked out the cloud yet at all. And it's ridiculous. They're so late. I'm the same. I use Google for pretty much everything that's not OS or hardware.
Yeah.
Actually, we use, for the business, we're using Office 365, which is equally as stable. We did have an issue at one point about a year ago. One of the guys had 20,000 contacts. Well, he has 20,000 contacts. He was syncing them to his phone, and then the phone would basically drop the connection. And then he would resync, and it wouldn't overwrite. It would just create new contacts. So he ended up with four or five contacts.
Million contacts.
Yes. Yeah, which when you've got 20,000 is...
Yeah. So the only way to do that was to nuke his phone and then resync. But that was an Apple issue, but that was fixed in an update. So he doesn't have that problem anymore.
Yeah.
I think there's a there's probably a Doug's Apple. Have you been to Doug's Apple Scripts?
I have, yeah, I love them.
It's great, and I'm sure there's one that goes through your contacts, looks for duplicates and stuff, and is able to sort them out. If that helps,
I found an app actually. There's an app in the App Store that is a duplicator. Oh. Yeah, maybe more than one, in fact.
Yeah, no, Doug's scripts are brilliant. I got one for resubmission or resubscription for podcasts. If you naturally elapse from your subscription, it comes back. Good answers, thank you. Next one from Rosemary. Mail app keeps asking me for my passwords and for my email addresses. I've told it to remember the password, but it keeps popping up every so often. Thanks, Rosemary. She says addresses here, so I'm guessing there's a Gmail involved somewhere.
Mail app has a habit of, if it can't, we've had this quite a lot recently, I don't know whether it's been an update or something, but if it can't reach the mail server, and that might be because you've lost internet connection, it throws, rather than throwing a no network connection error, it throws the password's wrong error. And so it'll ask you for your password. And if you type that in wrong or you don't bother typing it in, it'll add another keychain entry, which then is the wrong keychain entry. And so you'll carry on getting this issue. So I actually fixed this today for someone. If you go into your keychain, which is in your utilities folder, do a search for your email address, and you'll see some entries come up in the little list at the below. If you then click on all of those and delete them all, you probably have to have your mail app closed at this point, actually. But delete all those keychain entries, then open up mail again. It'll ask you for your password. Make sure you type in your correct password, and it'll make your correct keychain entry, and you'll be good to go.
Another thing that can cause this is too simple a password. If Gmail thinks that your password's too easy, it won't allow you to save it in external apps. So it'll still allow you to log into the Gmail website, but if it won't actually save it in like IMAP settings or something like that, it'll just keep on saying that it's incorrect. So I've experienced that. I've never experienced it on mail.app. I've never seen that before, but on Thunderbird on Windows, I had a customer who was having that issue, and all it was they just need to have a more complex password, and that was it.
Yeah, I mean, I know that Gmail, if it opens at too many IP locations, it kind of raises a flag and says, no, come on, just put your password in again as well. Mm-hmm. If I don't know, maybe she's got an iPhone as well that's polling, and the old MacBook and this one and something else, then.
They've just changed the two-factor authentication. You can turn on two-factor authentication. Is it called two-factor?
Mm-hmm.
Or two-stage?
Yes. Text,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I had a problem with an iPhone this week, actually, where we were typing in the correct password, but it wasn't. It was coming up and throwing the error that the password is wrong on his phone when it was working on webmail and it was working in his web his mail client. But that ended up being a two-factor. Still don't know what it is.
Two-factor
authentication thing.
Yeah, because in your iPhone, you have to actually set up an app-specific password that's only for that app on some things that don't support two-factor authentication, or whatever we're calling it. So you have to actually go into your Gmail account, and under security, I think it is, and under applications, you can set up a specific password for some software that doesn't support two-factor.
Okay. There you go, Rosemary. I hope we helped-ish. If you've got questions for us, send them in to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com, and we'll have a stab at answering them. Try and put as much information as you can into it, and then we've got a better chance, perhaps. An example of that is the next question, which is squarely aimed at Sarah. Hi, Help Show. I hope Sarah can help me. I'm trying to install Mint in a VM on my system, but I'm getting a problem, no root file system defined. I'm installing from a CD that I've burned, and I've made a partition for the installation. I get the welcome screen for the installation, but the partition doesn't show up, and I've got the above error message. Sorry for being a bit vague, but I can't seem to find any further information to make any headway. Ron Smythe, Portsmouth. Sarah, start us off at least.
I was a little bit surprised by partition and VM being in the same question, because normally you don't partition within the virtual machine, so I'm a little bit confused by that one.
Maybe that's he's partitioned the OS and put the VM on that.
It's possible. Yeah, the host is partitioned and the VM he's putting all the VMs within that, as you say. I would say in that situation, it's particularly with Mint and a lot of Linux distros, you don't actually need to install. I use VMware, and I apologize if this doesn't apply with other virtual machine software, but it certainly with VMware, it works fine. You don't actually need to create a CD to do that. The way to do it is to download the ISO file from the distribution, the distro site, and then when you go into VMware I use VMware Workstation on a PC. If you go into that, you create a new virtual machine, and then you give it the address of where the ISO file is, and it will build the the Mint install within the VM just from the ISO file. That's probably the best way to do it.
I'm using my own experience here from OS X, but I mean, when you try and install OS X, you get the opportunity to go to Disk Utility and create partitions for installation. Does Linux do the same thing?
You wouldn't want to do that within a VM.
No, but I'm just saying, if you wanted to create a partition to install, can't you do that from the utility?
You can do that. You can use, it's not GParted. I've forgotten the name of the one that you can, the boot manager. Yeah, yes, you can install it because when you boot a VM, if you create a new VM that has got nothing in it, it's like booting a machine with no operating system on it. So it gives you the ability to put a partition manager on it before you actually boot that VM anyway. So yeah, you could do that and then have multiple OSs within that. But the whole point about having VMs really is you shouldn't ever need to have multiple operating systems within one VM because you just create different VMs for each operating system you're going to have.
Right.
So it does matter what they're using to virtualize, though, because if they're if Ron is using ESXi or something like that, then it is quite a lot different to that. And you can partition things, and you have to link things, and you have to link file systems, you have to link ISOs to the instance and whatnot. So it'll be handy to know exactly what he's trying to, what the software he might be using, the VirtualBox. If he's using VirtualBox, then it's slightly different to Parallels or any of the other ones. ESXi is you know, you install it on a computer, and it is, you know, when you boot it up, it comes up as a black screen, and then you have to log into it from the web and from a Windows machine and stuff like that. So there is a massive difference with how you deal with this on different virtual or emulating environments,
What's no root file system kind of inferring, though?
Well, that's just because it can't find anything to the root file system. In this case, is going to be a CD, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, its chances are that the CD is not mounted as a removable device within the VM when he boots the VM.
Yeah, so in ESXi, you'd have to go into it, and once you've created a new machine, you click on it, go to the settings, and then you'd, if it's not already added, you'd have to add the CD drive as a function of that VM. And then you'd have to make sure that the boot sequence was booting to that CD before anything else. Mm. It's relatively complex, but I mean he might not be using ESXi, he might be using VirtualBox.
His first rule is to probably go and look at the settings in his VM and see if he's got his CD enabled as a device.
You go through this as Rick was explaining, when you create a new VM, whether it's in ESXi or in Workstation or VirtualBox or anything, you have to go through and make sure you've got all the hardware attached in the same way before you can actually install it, in the same way that you did with a brand new machine with no operating system. You make sure the boot sequence is correct because it's going to go through exactly the same checks when it tries to boot that VM.
Okay, good. There you go, Ron. Let us know how you get on, mate, eh? I hope it works. Next one's from Colin in Southampton. I've got an old Toshiba laptop which runs an old piece of equipment that's pretty much irrelevant. The batteries I have, there are two of them in the laptop, are NIMH, and I've lasted pretty well, but now don't hold a charge for very long. They can take up to 2 hours to show a full charge, but then they'll dissipate in around 20 minutes. I'm doubtful of getting replacements that will be in any better state due to the age of the laptop. I wonder if I could replace the internal packs with lithium power cells myself or get someone to do that.
Wow.
Like the blue touch paper in Retreat.
there's all sorts of issues, irrespective of the type of power cell you're using. There's all sorts of issues about voltage and current and stuff like that, which you'd have to get absolutely spot on. As I know from different manufacturers, part of the reason why they put these in them rather than replaceable units is because they tend to be very specific voltages and currents for that particular model. So as he says, the chances of finding something you can replace it with, I mean, it's not impossible, and also with a laptop, it's very small. So you've not only got to get something that's the same, you know, the same, got the same numbers on it, but effectively it's got to be out of fit as well. So unless you get it from the manufacturer, you're probably going to be out of luck.
Booker in the chat room says only homebrew L-ion batteries are chargeable if you've got good home insurance. Spot on. We just go ahead, mate.
I would be interested to know in some of these older laptops that don't need so much power, how many potatoes you need to power one of those laptops.
I mean, I know what you said. One other thing that did occur to me. I mean, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but you could try and see if there's anything on eBay or anything like that for an existing laptop. You could buy an old laptop that's the same laptop. Obviously, you're going to have the same issues with the age of the laptop. But however, if you're lucky and you find one that hasn't been used too much, you might be able to get good replacements. So certainly going to get more than 20 minutes of life out of it.
Mm-hmm. My quadcopter has interchangeable with lithium and NiMH batteries. And I don't think it, like you say, Sarah, as long as you get the voltage and current right, then I don't think it doesn't mind. But that might be just a special feature of my quadcopter controller. I think you should absolutely try this and make sure you film outside. It for everyone.
Yeah, but outside and make sure it's got a cheap camera next to it.
Yeah.
You don't mind losing. I think that's an interesting one because I've got a fantastic old camera that runs NiMH batteries. And those batteries are going to wear out at some point. They're running fine just now, but I'm not going to get replacements soon. It would be good. You'd like to think that Canon would come out with a replacement battery that had the latest battery technology for an old unit, but I mean, whether they're still in use or not, I don't know. But
actually, Canon are good for keeping their battery tech around because I have an old VHS video Hi8 video camera here, which uses a battery which you can still get, and it's an NPF 550 battery, and these ones are still available. So at least Canon are good for that. I've also in the past. I've managed to source batteries for laptops which are around anything up to 10 years old. So, and that's just by searching on the internet and finding a manufacturer that does them.
I did go to RS Components when I got this question and had a look, and they do a Toshiba battery insert, and it's not the battery. You can tell it's not the battery housing. You can tell it's the battery that fits in the housing. But it was discontinued, which kind of stops that story dead, doesn't it? But
that also probably means that you're not going to be able to probably get away. Even Toshiba probably wouldn't be able to help you.
Yeah. So
because that's probably where they get it from.
Yeah, bad luck, mate. I don't know what you're using it for, but you're going to have to use it off mains from now on.
Yeah.
we won't read it out, Colin. Promise you. But just to satisfy our own curiosity, for Christ's sake, tell us what you're doing with that you can't tell us. Because that's brilliant. I got to know. I won't sleep tonight.
The old piece of equipment, yeah.
Yeah, I want to know what the old piece of equipment is and whether anyone's going to get hurt if you have to stop using it or what. I don't know.
It's running the internet. No one knows. No one knew. It's actually an old Toshiba laptop that's running the whole internet.
It could well be. Next question is from Dwayne, our tame Brazilian from Leicester. Dear Help Show, I used to use a free WebDAV Dropbox service called Otixo. To export my OS documents to Dropbox. Is there a free alternative? No. Dropbox do an iOS app, so...
Well, this is what I was thinking, because I do the same thing in both my Android devices. If you install the native Dropbox app, it will pick stuff up anyway, if you ask it to.
Is that the end of that question?
Yeah, I mean, I can't answer for iOS, so I assume it's the same.
Yeah, the Dropbox app on iOS is pretty poo, though. I don't like it. It doesn't actually show your folder hierarchy. For iPhone, I should say. It just shows it chronological. It's all the files that you've opened chronologically or added or created or whatever. It's pretty poo. There are lots of other iOS apps that you can use that. So a lot of them are actually integrated with like Office-based apps, so like Office 2 and things like that. So if you want to open up your iOS documents and then create iOS documents and save them straight into Dropbox, you can do it from those kind of services too.
Have you got a name for anything that'll do iOS?
It's Office 2 or Office Squared Office or 2. Something like that. Right, Office okay. HD Squared. To be honest, I rarely make documents anymore, but that was one that I used to use. I'll see if I can find a link and I'll pop it in the chat room. I think it's like Office HD 2 or Office HD. Oh no, it's Office Squared HD. That's it, by Byte Squared.
Sachs in the chat room reckons he's worked out Colin Alford's I've said his surname, I shouldn't have said that really, should I? A favourite wife buzzing pleaser that takes a massive battery. There we go. Well done, Sachs. Thanks, mate. He did say not to read that out, but I'm afraid you can't do
is that.
You
put it in the chat room,
it's
public.
It's like a bread maker, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, bread maker.
It just makes really good bread. next question from Josh. Oh, no, it's answer. Thank you. Dear Help Show, I tried your tip regarding recording my video while playing Minecraft. I made it work as long as I don't put Minecraft full screen before recording, yeah, as my FaceTime video doesn't stay on top. Thanks for the help, Joshua Brack. We help someone. See, we do help people. Send us your questions. We help you. BritishTechNetwork@gmail.com. Want to do a quick sponsor advert before we go on any further. We've got loads more questions yet, though. UK2.net, they're absolutely fantastic. They support us. They've got a brand new logo, which I need to put on this promo. They've got tons of stuff going on. They're really, really great. They've got fantastic support and help. Great offers for BTN listeners, loads of offer codes, and they look after us. They've picked up hosting for us for now for 4.5 years. And at the start, we'd have gone bust without them. The server they provide us is £400 a month. It gives us unlimited bandwidth. It gives us unlimited storage. And we'd be lost without them. So please support UK2. Give them your business for hosting. They're a good company. They're a real good company. They like getting it right. And I've got to say, I've had a few run-ins with local social media and stuff like that about what their level of support is. You know, why give social media if it's just going to piss people off when you reply and you want to start an argument with them? UK2 social media is spot on. It works, it helps, it supports, and it provides information. So check them out. UK2, they're absolutely brilliant. Next question. We haven't got another question. That's the end of the questions. So I need to do the network. Yeah, I'll edit, don't worry. The network union advert. I was with my accountant yesterday, and he said, we've got a service provider, and I know we aren't getting what we should be getting for our internet service. And I said, well, who are you with? And he said, well, we're kind of BT, but we aren't. We're signed up through this other firm, and they deal with it. And he told me the name of the firm. I'm like, oh, right, I get what they're doing. Well, you want to talk to these guys, the network union. They're not a link in between you and BT. Your relationship with BT is still the same. You pay your bills with BT, no difference. But what the network do is add an extra level of support between you and BT. They don't take a cut out of the fee that goes to BT or anything like that. And so I got Rob on from the network union, put him onto Athos, who used to do the profit show on here, which may be coming back soon. And he said he explained everything that happened and what they thought they weren't getting. And Rob said, yeah, it's okay, no problem, we'll help you with that. You need to obviously get away from these people, but once you have, we can help you smooth the relationship between you and BT. And that's the point, is the network union smooth the relationship between you and BT. Make sure you're getting the right thing. Make sure you're getting the service that you're paying for, which Athos definitely isn't from the people that he's currently with. So support the network union because they support us. They provide all the pipe work in here to get the video shows out the door and up to you guys. They're wonderful, really nice people. And when you go to them, go to the British Network and click on sponsors and use them for UK2 and the network union. But when you give them your email address, here's the innovation. They'll only use it to contact you about the request for information. They will not be selling it on, and they will not be storing it so they can badger you constantly. Once you've talked to them, that's the end of it, if it's all over. Click through. Click through, says Paul. Click through now. Vote now. Lines close soon. I don't know. Patreon.com as well. We've still got Patreon.com running. If you'd like to support us, you can go to the support us link on the homepage and all the other pages at the top, and it takes you to the Patreon page. Give us a dollar. If you think we're worth 60 pence a month for the shows that we provide you, we've got 6 shows running out here now. So, you know, come on, help support us. We take the money and we put it into good services. We got rid of Justin so we could have live stream. We're going to get Paul a better microphone because it's going to kill the rest of us if we don't. And all of the stuff will go back into BTN to make the shows better, to make them slicker, to make them work. And I want to say a big shout out, thank you very much, to iSkelter. iSkelter make the Slate Pro and the Slate Mobile and the Slate Go. And I've got to say, they're absolutely brilliant. to vote for Slim Shadwell, dial 0800 Chieftain, says Paul. Not wrecking the sponsors out at all. iSkelter are absolutely brilliant. And iSkelter, when we get the new studio, we're gonna flip through 90 degrees and it's going to be wonderful. iSkelter providing the desks for us so that they'll look absolutely gorgeous and spangly in here. Check out David and iSkelter at iSkelter on Twitter or iSkelter.com because they're brilliant, really, people. Make sure you tell them that BTN sent you because they're brilliant. Right. We don't do the cool thing on this show. We do the cool tip. So who'd like to start us off? Who's got a cool tip?
I'll go first.
Middle of nowhere. Go, Sarah.
I know we slightly touched on the freeware, shareware thing earlier in an earlier question, but I thought one of the things that is always important, and this is particularly as a Linux user, but I think it equally applies to other operating systems as well, is if you're thinking of buying something like Microsoft Office, and I know a lot of people use it, but you don't have to. There's plenty of free software out there that will do the job just as well. Like in the case of Microsoft Office, you could use OpenOffice or LibreOffice, which will do the job. And the key thing is have a look, see what's out there before you spend hard-earned cash on expensive solutions, particularly for personal use.
OpenOffice is another good one that still runs really well.
That's why I said OpenOffice or LibreOffice.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. Sorry, I only heard LibreOffice. Do apologise.
I mean, you know, if you're looking for other ones, I'd say for image manipulation, things like GIMP, available on Windows and Linux. I think it may be available on Mac as well, but I wouldn't think you would need it on a Mac. But yeah, there's plenty of good examples out. You can find free software to do most things.
Okay, good one.
I've never quite worked out why they thought that GIMP was a good name for that software.
No, it is a weird name, but it's a great tool.
It really is. It's very good. You can get on Mac, but I've not used it for a little while, but you need to have it running in some kind of different...
It uses X11.
Sort of a bubble. X11, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, cool stuff. Yeah. But it did run in separate windows, but it runs in a unified window now.
Ah, does it?
The new one,
I've not used it for a while.
No. It's very good. And the other one's Acorn. Acorn's extremely good.
And it's that free?
No, it's $20.
Yeah, Pixelmator as well, while we're throwing out names of Mac apps.
No, they're good, very good.
But yeah, things like Audacity as well for recording audio.
Audacity is beautiful.
Mm. Yeah, you know, there's great stuff out there.
Audio Hijack Pro does multiple tracks as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, good picks, thank you. Good tips. Anyone else?
Yeah, I've got one. I kind of always known this worked, but I never actually tried it until very recently, and I've started using it more and more. So if you're on your iPhone, presumably it works on your iPad as well, but I've never tested it. If you're on your iPhone, and if you have to put an email address in a form field, and it's not been, the page hasn't been written correctly for mobile devices, and you don't get the email address keyboard popping up, and it's quite annoying. If, like me, I've got a lot of dots in my email address, so you have to kind of switch keyboard, tap dot, switch back again, and so on and so forth. There's quite a cool little thing you can do. If you just hold, so you're writing in your email address like Paul, and then you need to go to the dot. If you tap and hold on the button that gets you your second keyboard or the secondary keyboard, and keep your finger on the screen and just swipe across, if you like, to the dot, and then let go, it puts the dot in and then returns you to the previous keyboard. So in one fluid motion, you just hold on the secondary keyboard, swipe across, and let go on the dot, and then it moves you back to the other keyboard. And you can keep doing that as much as you like. But the nice thing is it just saves you a couple of taps on the screen when you're writing in an email address. So the same applies for the at sign as well. It's cool. It's a cool little thing that I've always kind of known was there, but I've never really used. And now that I've started kind of forcing myself to use it a bit more, it is so handy.
Excellent. Good tip. Booker in the chat room says, doesn't GIMP stand for Graphical Image Manipulation Program?
It does.
Probably.
Well corrected. And Streak says also, Seashore is a good alternative if you're on OS X. It's based on the GIMP code, but it's built for the system in UI terms as well. Like I say, GIMP used to run in separated windows. You used to have everything all over the shop. It used to look bloody awful. And one of the points that Rindwider makes is... GIMP's great, but it looks like shit. So there you go.
Well, right. I have to say...
But it's not anymore.
On Linux, that's the case with a lot of software. I mean, Audacity doesn't... You know, you close an individual file down and it closes the whole program. And that I find incredibly irritating. Mm. There are lots of little things like that that are incredibly irritating. They don't tend to be the best looking. But I'm all about... what it does and does it do the job rather than does it look brilliant, and you know, most of the time that's what you need software for.
Excellent. Who's next?
I have one.
Go for it. Yeah.
Have you done Applejack before?
No, what's this?
Applejack is a little bit of software that runs in single user mode on your Mac. It's only for the Mac. I'm sure there's Windows ones and Linux ones, but this particular one is for the Mac, and it's available from SourceForge. What you do is you download it and install it. It won't put a little application in your applications folder or anything like that. It's a command line tool that you have to get to by, if you start up your Mac holding down Command and S for sugar, and that puts you into something called single user mode, which is a good place to troubleshoot a Mac anyway. But this thing actually, it does a load of good tasks on your Mac to get it running nicely. So as you start up in single user mode, it'll go very matrix and all black screen and white text and stuff. And then you just type in A for autopilot. You'll see this is all explained in the little screen. But you type in A and it'll go through and it'll repair your disk. It'll repair your permissions. It'll clean up your cache files, validates your preference files, removes your swap, and other bits and pieces as well. So it's a really handy little tool to have just for everyday sort of maintenance of your machine. And it's available from applejack.sourceforge.net.
Windrider in the chat room is saying, love Apple Jack, still works on Mavericks as well, well worth having. And Sax has put in, GimpShop.com will give you an add-on that makes your GIMP look like Photoshop UI, which is excellent, because that's what it needs, no question. Excellent. Paul, have you got anything for us?
Yes. I do, actually. This last week or so, I've been transferring a lot of old magnetic videotapes to digital. So I've got this old camera, which is actually a Canon. Oh, sorry, no, it's not. It's a Sony.
Is this the Canon camera you held up earlier?
Yeah, that's the. This is a Sony Video High 8 camera, which I used. And I've got a lot of these old tapes going back to the sort of early 90s when I was recording my kids and other things. And to transfer the videos out of there into my Mac, I've been using a thing called a Blackmagic Intensity Shuttle. And that's it there. And so you can see I'm going through the old video connections with audio into that. I have HDMI in. I also have a composite video in. And that is composite video in. S-video. And yeah. And it connects into my Mac via the Thunderbolt port. There's also a USB 3 version of this as well. And it transfers the videos in pretty good quality. And then some of the tapes are a bit naff, but I've been able to use Final Cut Pro to clean them up as well. And I've started posting them on Vimeo.
So is it basically a capture card?
Yes, that's effectively what it does.
But it's an external capture card, which is cool. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent. So get your old videos off, Mrs.
Something like that.
You love Blackmagic, don't you? Why don't you got a black? Why haven't they sent you a free T-shirt yet, Paul?
I have no idea. Actually, this is my latest acquisition. This is a HyperDeck shuttle
from Blackmagic.
From Blackmagic, yeah.
Which does what?
They do make some cool kits. I know that.
And they're priced reasonably well as well. The HyperDeck Shuttle takes SSD drives and allows you to record video directly onto them. So if you've got it works even with DSLR. So I can plug my DSLR into that via the HDMI port and it will record video directly to that.
That's pretty good. And at the speeds that you've got as well, if you've got Thunderbolt with that card, it's great. My tip is just what I said earlier on. Make sure you take cloths that are absorbent for rain and clean to do your lenses and that kind of stuff. Take some sandwich bags, keep them clean, keep them dirty, keep them away from it, keep the contaminants away from your normal sources. And always buy the best lens you can possibly afford, no matter what. And then put a UV filter on it. Never, ever have a UV filter missing from your lens. The only lens I've got that hasn't got a UV filter on is my 50mm 1.8 because they're disposable. That's £90 for a brand new one of those, and I'll probably go through three of those in a year because they get such abuse. And don't do what I did with a 35mm 2.0 lens and drop it on the first day I used it and smash it.
Oh,
ouch.
Walked in, put it on the camera, shot a few shots with it, took it off, dropped it on the floor, threw it in the skip on the way out.
And also, make sure you don't put your sandwiches in the same bag as your cloths.
Well, so
if you use the sandwich bag, you know, you don't want to mix that up.
Bread's pretty absorbent, though.
Yeah, but jam. Jam's going to get
it. There is a jam issue, of course.
Butter's going to make a bit of a mess.
That's why I'm just an amateur. Waiters, where can we get Old You Boy?
You can find me on many other things on this network. It'll be The Gamer Show. And we're planning soon in the next couple of months, hopefully, start doing live. And The Pocket Show as well, going to be doing live. I'm thinking that we might do The Pocket Show and The Gamer Show on alternative Monday evenings when we eventually go live. So there'll always be something on this network on a Monday evening.
Are you getting excited?
I am getting very excited about what we'll do those shows live. I'm not really sure what it's going to do for the reputation of the network, being that Chiz and Sam will be completely uncensored. But we'll see how that goes. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm at Paul Wheatley on that fun piece of technology.
Excellent, mate. Where are you, Mr. Shadwell?
I'm right here. And
thank you for that.
Can be found on Twitter is Paul Shadwell, PaulShadwell, and no relation to Slim
Shadwell on Twitter. You follow at Slim Shadwell on Twitter for Paul's rapping skills, because Paul is a white homie. Sarah, where are you, mate?
Best place in many places, including, as Paul alluded, other shows on the network. But the best place to get hold of me is on the Twitters at Sarah Jane UK.
And Mr. McCorriston, where can they get hold of you?
I'm on Twitter as well at McCorriston, which is McCorriston, or fresh-tech.it.
Yes, the fine people that work out of London and support your systems. Brilliant.
We do.
Now, are we going to the Rugby Sevens this year, mate?
Oh, that's a question. I don't know.
You put me down for a ticket.
I will do.
Oh, we had a good time last year.
I can't remember.
From what I can remember.
I certainly didn't watch any rugby.
I remember doing a bong and then I don't remember anything else.
There could have been a swimsuit competition going on in the middle of that pitch and I wouldn't have any idea about it, to be honest.
Clue. I'm Ian Rankin. Get me at you on Twitter. I'm Ewan Rankin. You can get me at Ewan Rankin on Twitter. And we're back in tomorrow with the big show as normal. And I'm going to edit this and I'm going to post it. So we'll be on the iTunes store very, very soon, I promise. Have a great weekend and see you soon. Thanks for listening. Send us your stuff, britishtechnetwork@gmail.com.